From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. Writer, filmmaker, and social critic Tariq Ali says on September 11th, the United States reaped what it had sown for 30 years. And, he says, the U.S. continues to flaunt its imperialist ways. This hour, Tariq Ali on blowback imperialism and American fundamentalism. But first, a new study prepared by a private contractor estimates that pollution from more than 8 power plants owned by 8 electric utilities will cause almost 6,000 premature deaths in 2007. Earlier today, I spoke with Leland Deck. He's vice president of Apt Associates, the Cambridge, Massachusetts technical consulting firm that conducted the study. I asked him who commissioned the study and how it was designed.
Eric Schaefer approached us to do this study with the support of the Rockefeller Family Fund, and we actually ended up with being commissioned by the Rockefeller Family Fund to do this study.
Well, how was the study designed, and how did you go about it?
The study looks at the total air pollution impacts of 8 different power companies, power systems they are called. Instead of looking at individual plants, we are looking at the impact of the systems as a whole, the collective impacts of the 8 companies throughout the Middle Eastern United States: American Electric Power, Synergy, Duke, Dynergy, First Energy, SEGECO, Southern Company, and the TVA. We looked at each system independently, and we looked at all of them collectively. This is the total impact on one form of air pollution.
And what form is that?
Particulate matter, and the small form of it known as PM2.5. That is probably the most dangerous form of common ambient air pollution.
And how did you estimate the premature death?
Our model analysis starts with emissions from the plants. It then estimates through time and space how particulate matter is formed across the area and to every part of the United States. Then, using epidemiological information relating the PM2.5 in the air to excess cases of health effects, we were able to, using common methods well-documented in the literature, with one exciting exception.
What's that?
February of this year, a new health study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that relates premature mortality to particulate matter. In their study, it was the first time that they found a statistically significant, stable relationship between PM and lung cancer. This study we released yesterday, to the best of my knowledge, is the first application
of that.
And, for instance, we did estimate the total impact of all of these power companies collectively leads to approximately 5,900 premature deaths. We were looking out in the year 2007, which is when all of the current air pollution programs that are now underway will have pretty much taken effect.
Well, what would have to be done to prevent this? I mean, if everything will be legal and still causing this, if everything will be in accord with environmental regulations, don't we need new regulations, and what would they be?
Currently, the EPA has brought suit against these 8 companies, making the legal claim that 51 of the power plants owned by these companies are not, in fact, legal at this point. These are old power plants.
Yes.
The common word is used. These have been grandfathered under the laws pre-existing before the Clean Air Act came into place.
Mm-hmm.
However, since that time, which was way back in 1970, these plants that are operating then, they've been rebuilt, improved, had major modifications done to them over the intervening course of time. EPA is now suing them, saying these plants should meet new source standards because over the period of time they have been they have been rebuilt in so many ways, they should be caught under new source review
right.
laws.
Right. And if the EPA wins this suit, will that change your calculation?
If the EPA wins this suit, each and every one of these, a major portion of the 5,900 deaths will be taken care of. Not all of it. Mm-hmm. Our analysis is basically, what if the plants no longer existed? Well, that's not going to happen. However, the settlements would likely come out that each plant of the major plants would have to reduce maybe 70, 80, or 90% of their emissions. And if that's the case, they would get 70, 80, or 90% of these premature deaths would be avoided from these power plants, now, according to our estimate.
And what struck me about your projection of deaths, this isn't just in New England. I mean, we've been used to the notion of particulate matter from Midwestern power plants getting here. You have it happening in Ohio, in Pennsylvania.
In fact, that is where the majority of our deaths are coming from. The power plants that are directly affected by they're owned by these companies, are not New England plants. There's a few in Pennsylvania, and by and large, they go from Pennsylvania down through Texas. However, air pollution travels a long way. The air pollution model that we're using says that any individual power plant will have a noticeable impact up through 500 or 700 miles away. So while in our report we are estimating the per state number of deaths that add up to 5,900, and the majority of our impacts are in, for instance, Pennsylvania has the highest single number of deaths predicted. That's not only by any means coming from the Pennsylvania plants, but also from other plants that are essentially upwind of Pennsylvania.
But what you're also pointing out, some of it winds up in Kentucky and Indiana and the places where it's produced.
That's right. That's, more of it stays at home.
Yeah,
and
right.
There's sort of two, all of the mathematics behind the study, two things matter, how much air pollution a state is getting and how many people live there.
Right.
Obviously, Pennsylvania is a very populous state.
We should point out that the director of the Edison Electric Institute says, given our experience with these authors, with their database, with their modeling methodology, we have strong suspicions that this work is not credible. What do you say to that?
That is a claim that the Edison Electric Institute and other members of the utility industry have long been making. What we have used here is what EPA uses. It's the methods, it's the tools that EPA has been using for some time. We do a lot of that analysis mm-hmm. for them. Mm-hmm. The utility industry is strongly disagreeing with EPA that that power plant emissions are associated with health effects. I would like to point out that in this study, we're not only estimating the number of deaths, we are estimating a full range of health effects going from the most severe, which is obviously premature mortality, but we're also doing hospital admissions, upper and lower respiratory symptoms, you know, colds and flus associated with it, asthma attacks, work loss days, and my own personal favorite, minor restricted activity days, which is basically you get up, you feel like heck, but you go to work anyway.
Leland Deck is vice president of Apt Associates Incorporated. He spoke to us from Bethesda, Maryland. It was the most visible act of mass violence in history, and tonight's guest says September 11th was the consequence of U.S. imperialism. Since his days leading London student protests against the Vietnam War, Tariq Ali has been a defiant voice on the European left. In his view, our imperialism is as rigid and unyielding as any religious fundamentalism. If decades of U.S. foreign policy yielded September 11th, what will its current approach bring? Do you believe that we are reaping where we have sowed in the past? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now in the studio is Tariq Ali. He's a filmmaker, activist, and the author of 12 books. His latest is The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity. He's also an editor of the New Left Review. Welcome to On Point.
Very nice to be with you.
Well, thank you for coming. You write, or said in an interview, which I assume you You could have written it. You're right. After flirting with neo-isolationism, the U.S. is now deciding it wants to run the world. The U.S. should come out openly and say to the world, we're the only imperial power, and we're going to rule you, and if you don't like it, you can lump it. American imperialism has always been the imperialism that has been frightened of speaking its name. Now it's beginning to do so. In a way, it's better. We know where we kneel. tough medicine for we Americans who think ourselves such a good people. You talk about American imperialism as a kind of fundamentalism, but first we have to establish the imperialism. Make your case. You give a short course of arguing of American imperialism. Give us the shorter version of the short course.
Well,
how is it this is an imperialist country?
Well, I think it's an imperialist country by virtue of the fact that as the 20th century and in the 19th century, when the old imperialist powers in Europe were jostling with each other for colonies, for a while the United States restricted itself to its locality. It took parts of Mexico in the very early days. Later on, it moved abroad and took Philippines, but by and large, it stuck to Latin America. And I quote in The Clash of Fundamentalisms that very fine American general, Major General Smedley Butler, General of the Marine Corps, who General MacArthur said was one of the finest American generals in our history. And General Smedley Butler wrote a book called War as a Racket. And in that, he compared himself, while he was General of the Marine Corps, to Al Capone. He said, the difference is Al Capone operated in three neighborhoods. I operated as a hitman for the corporations in three continents, and he names goes through countries. I took Guatemala for this company. I took Nicaragua for this company. I made Cuba safe for the First National City Bank. It's an absolutely wonderful, rip-roaring account of his days as an imperialist swashbuckler. And there has been always in American history, generals, writers, Mark Twain, for example, who have come out very openly and denounced America's imperial power. Gore Vidal today does it endlessly. So I don't think there's any doubt about it. What's different between the United States and other imperialist powers traditionally is that by and large, with some exceptions, they have not ruled directly. They have not appointed their own viceroys who are Americans ruling other countries. They have tended to look in those countries for people who serve their interests. And that's the way it happened in the past, and that's the way it's going on now. And the latest proconsul we have is this unfortunate guy, Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan, who I'm afraid his days will not last long because that country is very unstable. And the fact I'd like you to give you, which will concentrate, I hope, many minds, is that there are 189 countries in the United Nations today. And according to the Department of Defense figures, the U.S. has a military presence in 100 of these countries. Mm. And this is after the Cold War enemy is gone, the evil empire, so-called, has been scattered to the winds. The world is a capitalist world. The free market prevails. But American military power is at its height.
Mm. Well, let's start with the past. I want to do a thought experiment with you. Mm-hmm. It's 1945. That the Second World War is over. The United States says, we're going to do what we did in 1918. We're going home and we're staying there. And by the way, French, British, the people we loan money to, pay it back. You're afraid of the Soviet Union? Hey, that's your lookout. You take care of it. We're going to take care of ourselves, and that's it. South Korea, Japan? Nope. Japan, you pay us for war indemnities and war damages and so on. We're going to come back to your answer after we're through. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
from Boston.
Is on point. We're talking with Tariq Ali, the author of The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity. And by the way, his fundamentalisms are the Al-Qaeda on one side and us on the other. Join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Just before the break, I laid out a picture essentially saying, what if in 1945 we had done what we did in 1918 and said to the world, go hang? And instead of helping our enemies revive, done them for the damage done to us and for the money we loaned to them. Question, would the world have been a better place without that exercise in American imperialism?
Well, you might have done that, but there was a problem, that imperialism had to function in a very different way after the Second World War, because you had the almighty power at that time of the Soviet Union, which had been given Eastern Europe during the Yalta agreements, which Churchill and Roosevelt agreed to, the spheres of influence theory, the containment policies advocated by George F. Kennan. But given that the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries ran Eastern Europe, given that China was in revolution, given that Vietnam was erupting, the United States, I mean, just being purely rational about it, behaved like a very responsible imperial power. Instead of going and crushing its old imperialist rivals, it revived them. The Marshall Plan is one of the most amazing things in world history, that this plan actually revived Europe, revived Japan, revived Germany, and built these countries up. And the reason they had to do that is that they needed to unite the capitalist world to confront the communist world. Without that, I mean, what is a more interesting question to me is, and of course no one knows, that if the Soviet Union had collapsed, it hadn't existed, and the world had been like it is now, what would the United States have done? It's an interesting question. But I think, given what the world was, they behaved, from their point of view, very rationally and very responsibly.
Churchill described the Marshall Plan as the most unsordid act ever committed by one nation in history. And, you know, there are a lot of Europeans who might say, well, but for American imperialism, we'd be in tough shape today. What I'm trying to say is this is a double-edged sword. American intervention in the world, I would posit, has not only been, you know, negative in the sense that we have, you know, in the sense the word imperialist connotes, but it has also been positive. Our intervention has helped us to buttress freedom and free markets, to be sure, around the world. So it's not like this is just some parable, simple story about American imperialism. Take us out of the world, and it's hard to argue, historically, it would be a better place.
Well, this is an open question. I mean, lots of people in Latin America would disagree with that. The Europeans are a very different people because they were great empires which had collapsed, and the United States came, and their empires collapsed soon, they were lifted and made into capitalist countries. But this was absolutely necessary from the interests of the United States itself.
Sure.
It didn't, I mean, after all, it entered the First World War after the collapse of the Russian regime and the Russian Revolution. That's what brought them into the First World War. And they waited a long time before they entered the Second World War. It was Pearl Harbor that basically brought them in. So they, in those days, they were more reluctant to intervene. They preferred to control Latin America, which the Monroe Doctrine, which they themselves had established, gave them. And then once they went into Europe after the Second World War, they realized what the scale of the problem was for their world.
Sure.
And so they stayed in.
Yes, yes. Enlightened behavior.
Well, enlightened self-interest.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed, indeed. But this is, as it were, a part of our intervention in the world that has been good for the world, certainly good for the West.
It's been very good for the West, obviously. It's not been so good for people in Africa, right. Asia, and Latin America.
Right. Let's take some calls. Marcia is on the line. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, we're glad to have you.
Thanks. Listen, with all due respect, sir, and I say this with all due respect, but I do resent what you're saying because I don't believe this to be true. I do believe that America has been thrust into this position. It just happens to be the timing and how events have laid themselves out. Because Europe collapsed, England at that time that you're talking about, after before World War II, was the great empire. Now, they ruined themselves. That was their choice. Partially because Germany stretched out all of their resources, the entire European resources. Therefore, America then got into the war, and then it happened, because it got into the war later, then landed in a good position and also brought our economy out of bad. Our economy was bad at that time, and because of the war, it enhanced our economy and then thrust us in a position of being a great power. So I don't agree with your assessment that we want to be imperialists. I think Americans, because most Americans don't live outside of this country, they don't have a good sense of how to interact with other cultures. Our culture embraces cultures and kind of brings them in, as opposed to if you live in Europe, all different cultures have to intermingle. Mm-hmm. So I can understand why Americans don't understand why people view them the way they do, and they don't truly understand their power. But to say that we're an imperialist culture like England or France, I don't agree with that.
Thank you, Marcia.
Well, it's very interesting. It's a point I make in my book that this has always been the imperialism that dared not speak its name. And it's very interesting that many citizens, American citizens, don't see themselves as an imperialist nation. But, you know, it's an interesting psychological phenomenon in the world reality. I mean, today, let's talk about today for a moment. The United States is the only empire in the world. This has never happened in world history before. Never. Not even in the times of the Romans did one empire dominate the world as the United States dominates it today. It's just a fact of life. It's the most powerful militarily. It's the most powerful nation in the world. Economically, it's very strong. Its hegemony is very well established. And currently, it has a leadership which thinks it can go and kick ass wherever it wants without anyone being able to say boo.
I'm afraid we lost Marcia for her response. Let's go to Dennis. Hello.
Hi there. I'm hearing the guest speak about America as an empire and about the United States as having an imperial agenda and a strategy of imperialism. And he's quoting a lot of thinkers throughout history who've, you know, shared this view. And he's speaking in very absolute terms about the American hegemony and it being an empire that rules the world. But I am hearing very, very few specific historical examples which would support this position. And what I would like to ask is, what basis in historical fact do you have for an overarching policy of imperialism and for the United States as an empire? Because really, the terms imperialism and empire are at least, at best, they're a metaphor for describing American policy and America's position in the world right now.
Mm. Thank you on that, Dennis. We'll get his response.
Yeah, I'm staggered that people doubt this fact, which is so obvious to the rest of the world, the whole of the 20th century. The United States fought cold wars, hot wars, to defeat the people it regarded as its enemy. It waged a long war in Vietnam, the only war it lost in their history. It waged a war in Korea, which it won. It waged a cold war against the Soviet Union, which ultimately it won. It toppled many democratic regimes in Latin America and replaced them with military dictatorships. It backed corrupt and evil dictators in most parts of Asia. Now, it didn't do this for fun. It did it because it felt it served its interests. And it also, one of the things it did, which it regrets now, or at least I think most of the establishment regrets it, is that throughout the 80s, they used Islam as a bulwark against communism and created a whole network of radical Islamist groups to go and fight the communists in Afghanistan, of which Osama bin Laden's group was one, trained, financed, funded, armed, by the United States and trained, by the way, in training camps in Arizona, where Afghanistan was simulated. So let's not have, there's no shortage of evidence. The question is, this has happened in the past. Where is it going to go now?
Dennis, your response?
Yes, I think that what you're describing is a powerful, engaged, nation in a community of nations faced with many different nations with many different policies, many different movements, communism, fascism, all sorts of radical extreme movements, and actually a nation that's by and large fractious within itself. So just to point to the examples of a nation which wages wars throughout the world, a nation which makes mistakes, that doesn't point to some sort of policy of imperialism. And you also say that, oh, throughout the world it's obvious to everyone, but that's not really true because not everyone in the world agrees with you. So again, you're kind of falling back into this absolutistic, it's so obvious to everyone because, yeah, the United States has dirty hands, but that doesn't mean it's a one-world government or some imperial power. And just one last thing, to justify or say that the United States sort of had it coming to the deaths of all the people in September 11th, that's just absurd. Mm. I mean, that's just, that's ethically, that's very complicated.
Dennis, thank you very much. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How about Dennis's last point? Mm. That about September 11th, that to say that somehow, or to suggest, you don't say, but to say that somehow we got what was coming to us is insensitive to the point of it to being offensive.
Well, Jack, I want to be very clear on this point. I have never said that. In fact, I go out of my way to criticize people who say that. I think that what took place on September the 11th was unjustifiable. It cannot be defended, but it has to be explained. Mm-hmm. And what I try and do is explain it. Now, blowback is a term not coined by me. It is actually a term coined by the Central Intelligence Agency in their documents. They said, given what's been going on, we have to be prepared for blowback. And the term was given currency by a very distinguished historian, Chalmers Johnson, who was once a leading CIA analyst and knows the establishment inside out.
And he's by blowback, he meant, tell us what blowback.
Well, by blowback, Chalmers Johnson explains that what the United States has been doing in the rest of the world will come back and hit us one day. And he was the only person, the only historian who 1 year prior to the September events predicted that this could mean terrorist attacks on the United States and its civilians. Now, defending it. Mm-hmm. Chalmers hates all this stuff, but he was just explaining mm-hmm. that given what the United mm-hmm. States has been up to, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's a pity no one paid any attention to what he was saying. That's all that's being said. And my desire, I tell you honestly, is to stop something like this ever happening again. And my fear is that the way the United States is going about it, it will happen again. Mm-hmm. And then what? You know, if some idiot group fed up with the situation in Palestine or the invasion of Iraq, if it takes place, decides to do something even more horrible. Mm-hmm. You know, will the United States then go and turn the country, supposedly, which did it, into a parking lot?
Yeah, yeah. Imran is on the line. We're at 1-800-423-8255, by the way. 1-800-423-TALK. Imran, hello.
Hi there. You know, I was going to say the fundamentalism that I kind of fear in clashing with the so-called Islamic fundamentalism is the Christian fundamentalism that goes on in this country. And if you listen to the rhetoric that comes out of, Pat Robertson and Franklin Graham and even Bill Bennett, and you look at the connections that they have into Washington, what I see is kind of this manipulation and influence in the White House and its foreign policies in how it deals with the Islamic world. And even domestically, if you look at John Ashcroft's statement about, Muslims basically sending their kids to, their children to die. And Christians, the difference was that with Christians that God sent his children to die for us. I mean, this type of rhetoric that starts in, the Christian right and basically bleeds into the White House and then manifests itself in its policies mm-hmm. is the fundamentalism that I see clashing with the Islamic one. And when you listen to the rhetoric of George Bush, you're either with us or against us, or Ashcroft, who says, anybody who dissents with the government is providing ammunition to the enemy, mm-hmm. it sounds very close to what Osama bin Laden says, which is those people who those Muslims who are not with us are basically coffers or, you know, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll stop there.
Let's get your response,
Well, I agree very much with Imran. I make this point myself in this book, that this whole line of if you're not with us, you're with the terrorists is absolute nonsense. There are large numbers of people all over the world, including the United States, who despise the terrorists, but who are equally hostile to what George W. Bush is doing. And this is also, by the way, true inside the world of Islam, where, I mean, I was recently in Pakistan, Egypt, and Turkey and had many, many conversations with Muslims who are of similar views, that they cannot agree with George W. Bush. On the other hand, they have totally hostile to the fundamentalists, and these people can't be written off.
Do you see this Christian element in our in our foreign policy that that Imran is talking about?
I don't know. I'm not totally sure whether it determines foreign policy. I think U.S. foreign policy is determined by its what it regards as its economic and strategic interests. I don't think Christianity plays a big role in it as such, though where I agree with Imran is that it is very noticeable, the degree of Christian fundamentalism in this regime. And of all the big Western states, There is more. I mean, the United States is saturated with religion. It's just a fact of life. 90% of the population regularly says that it believes in the deity, and 60% say regularly that they believe in angels. Somehow it'd be better if it were the other way around, because angels seem sort of more harmless somehow.
Yes, and there are statistics on the devil as well. Thank you, Imran. Yeah, the Christian element, it's part of sort of a American rhetoric, and as it were, the kind of implicit, spontaneous, unconscious of Americans. But they say these things, and they say, "Whoop, we're not supposed to say this." But I don't see a design. Although I'm certainly, I certainly see some of this in the Bush administration. When President Bush went to China, for example, his jaw dropped when the Chinese leader said, "I do not believe in God."
Yeah.
And Bush just bristled. Well, a lot of people don't believe in God who are perfectly fine Americans.
Well, exactly.
You know, it was an extraordinary, telling moment, as if he had said some heretical thing.
Well, I know. And I mean, I'm sure there are a number of American presidents whose own belief in religion was rather weak and faulty.
Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As we head into this break, let's listen to a song the Rolling Stones wrote about our guest tonight, Tariq Ali. This is Street Fighting Man. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Well, I hear the sound of
from Boston University, this is WBUR.
Jack Beatty, this is On Point. We're talking with Tariq Ali, author of The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity. And one of the fundamentalisms in that pair is our imperialism. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We want to get to our callers. But first, you conclude your book with a letter to a young Muslim. Who was the young Muslim, and can you read a passage from us?
The young Muslim was one of the many I've met all over the diaspora, Western Europe, North America, and some in the Muslim world itself. But curiously enough, Muslims in the Muslim world are less sort of depressed in some ways than the diaspora. But it's a question which comes everywhere. And so I wrote this letter to a young Muslim to explain why the hits were wrong, what the problems are with our own world, and why we have to really try and sort out our own problems.
And here's a passage.
This is one of the passages in this letter. I've met many of our people in different parts of the world since 11 September. One question is always repeated. Do you think we Muslims are clever enough to have done this? I always answer yes. Then I ask who they think is responsible. And the answer is invariably Israel. Why? To discredit us and make the Americans attack our countries. I gently expose their wishful illusions, but the conversation saddens me. Why are so many Muslims sunk in this torpor? Why do they wallow in so much self-pity? Why is their sky always overcast? Why is it always someone else who is to blame? Sometimes when we talk, I get the impression that there is not a single Muslim country of which they can feel really proud. Those who have migrated from South Asia are much better treated in Britain than in Saudi Arabia or the Gulf states. The Arab world is desperate for a change.
And you go on to say that it's in this climate that that fundamentalism, Al-Qaeda, arises. Why this sort of historical funk in the Muslim world? What has happened?
Basically, Jack, I think what happened was that all the attempts to create an alternative in the 50s, in the 60s, and the 70s were defeated. Some were defeated by internal deficiencies in the regimes themselves. Others were defeated by the United States, who feared any independent regimes coming which threatened the flow of oil. And the West, by and large, the British Empire first and the American Empire subsequently, preferred to put its faith in kings and sheikhs and sultans
shahs.
And shahs. And these wretches who still rule that world, I mean, if you look at Saudi Arabia today, it's a kleptocracy. A 10,000 family is basically milking that country of its wealth, and this creates total despair. And likewise, most of the regimes in the Gulf, they're completely unrepresentative. And so people despair. And then you have the moth-eaten dictatorship in Egypt, also backed by the West. Then on the other side, not backed by the West, you have Saddam Hussein and Bashar Assad, who've been in power with single-party states, crushing the aspirations of their people. So all in all, both pro- and anti-Western regimes are pretty awful.
Let's take a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Peter is on the line, and thank you for your patience.
Well, I wanted to raise the issue of the ideology of Islam. By ideology, I do not mean the observance of Ramadan or going on the Hajj or the almsgiving of the Zakat or so on. That is aspects of individual worship. I think that unless one clearly confronts, analyzes, assimilates, and thinks about some of the doctrines of political Islam, as Kemal Atatürk did.
He was the leader of Turkey who made it a secular state.
Well, he separated mosque and state, and that seems to have been, although it's not perfect, and occasionally the Turkish army intervenes, if any Muslim state seems to approximate a country which... how shall I put it? With which the infidels can live in Turkey. And those doctrines, I submit, are the following. One, the uncompromising division of the world between the Dar al-Islam and the Dar al-Harb, the domain of Islam and the domain of the infidel. Two, the use of jihad militarily, economically, through propaganda, and through migration to the lands of the infidels to further Islam until it, you know, the ultimate goal is to have it spread around the globe. Three, the absolutely uncompromising attitude toward the infidels, except insofar as the people of the book, Christians and Jews, may be subject to a legally enshrined second-class status as in high Islamic civilization. And unless this Dar al-Islam, I mean, I don't know how you modify without a Vatican with no vehicle to modify doctrines which are there. They're not made up by the Americans. And I want to say one more thing. American behavior does not explain the beheading of Christian Filipinos of Christian or Confucian Chinese in Indonesia, of black Christian and animists in the Sudan, or Christian and animist blacks in the Sudan, mm-hmm. nor many other cases mm-hmm. where Islam has nothing whatever to do with America's sins, omissions, commissions.
Peter, we have your point. Let's get Tariq Ali's response.
Well, I agree that the United States is not too directly responsible for what you've said in the last sentence, but I would put it to you that if one uses exactly the same logic as you use, one could argue that Christianity is responsible for the Christian fundamentalists who've been going around the United States bombing abortion clinics and knocking off doctors who perform abortions. It would be equally absurd. These are tiny groups, by and large, very sectarian groups, which have emerged within Islam. Which have challenged mainly Islamic rulers. And often, this is, you know, the whole thing is contradictory. The notion that these people stick by the book, to be perfectly frank with you, is nonsense. The Wahhabis, which is a puritanical sect reminiscent of the Plymouth Brethren, who emerged in Saudi Arabia, fought the Muslim Ottoman Empire in collaboration with the British, because they wanted the Ottomans who were occupying the Arab lands out. Islam played no role in it. In fact, they used their Islam as a nationalist ideology mm-hmm. to say that the Sultan in Turkey wasn't a proper Muslim. And quite often, these Islamic fundamentalists define the rest of the Islamic mm-hmm. world as pagan, as the mm-hmm. Jahiliya, as ignorant.
So you don't see you see divisions within the civilization that make it difficult to sort of venture this sort of overall characterization of political Islam.
Absolutely.
Peter, your response?
I think that no serious Western scholar would accept Tariq Ali's view of Islam. Fundamentalist, the very phrase Islamic fundamentalist, as the excellent Bassam Tibi has pointed out in his many books, doesn't make sense. All devout Muslims are essentially fundamentalists, and the word doesn't make sense. And to compare a handful of abortion doctors to tens of millions of people throughout the world, the Lashkar Jihad here, Jamaat-e Muhammad there, from Pakistan to Indonesia to the Philippines to the Sudan to places in Paraguay, is utterly absurd. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Come on, it's not tens of millions. It's just nonsense to say they're tens of millions. All these people are a minority within their own countries. In Pakistan, in three successive general elections, these fundamentalist groups got less than 5% of the vote. So let's not, you know, get too carried away by this sort of hostility to the culture of Islam.
Well, I think Peter knows a good deal about the culture of Islam. Peter, thank you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is on the line, and thank you for waiting.
Hi. On the subject of divisions within civilizations, is it really proper to speak of an American imperialism or of an imperialism that suits certain and perhaps changing elements within American culture, and to raise a cold-blooded, amoral question, who in America doesn't benefit from it, and can America really be expected to behave any differently? And how do groups get, you know, how are groups brought in line to endorse the continuation of the policy? Maybe it's what's rational for us.
Yes. In other words, our foreign policy, our imperialism.
Yes, or at least for enough of us, or enough of us with power, even though we also have different interests among ourselves, that mm-hmm. there will always be enough support to be brought behind it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, you know, that's certainly a view. I mean, the other view is, of course, it's kind of an elite hoax on a basically isolationist people who want the rest of the world to go do what it wants to do, but leave them alone. But let's get Tariq Ali's view.
Well, I think in the past, certainly when the British and French empires existed, it was clear that the economic gains these empires made did benefit large sections of their population, though not everyone. Even here, it can hardly be argued that the 40% of the American population who lives below the poverty line benefits from empire.
40% of our population doesn't live below
the poverty line.
Well, we have a lot of poverty, but it's about 15%.
15%. Okay. Well, let's say 15%.
It's a disgrace.
Do they benefit from the U.S. Imperial adventures abroad? Mm-hmm. I don't think they do, and yet probably the ideology of being part of an empire is something which they accept, like large numbers of working class people in Britain who were very poor accepted that ideology, because precisely because they were poor, they said, at least we're something, we're citizens of an empire. Yeah. And I think this is probably quite a strong belief, which can be challenged and was challenged when the empire was being defeated by the Vietnamese. You had one of the most amazing anti-war movements in the history of the world. And I always say this when I'm debating Muslim fundamentalists, what scares the Pentagon generals more? Some idiots who hijack a plane and crash it in a section of the Pentagon which can be rebuilt? No. What really worries them is when GIs in uniform in their thousands demonstrate outside the Pentagon and say they want the other side to win.
Yes, that was a... Bob is calling from Spokane, Washington, and thanks for waiting.
Hi. Your guest there described the United States as like the most powerful empire in the world today, which obviously it is, and also historically speaking, probably we have the largest share of world power of any country ever has. And I wonder, I mean, I wouldn't even particularly argue the point with him, but I wonder how he feels we behave ourselves given the grip on world power we have compared to the past empires. He mentioned Rome and, you know.
Good question. How do we stack up?
Well, you know, the Romans built roads all over the world, and actually these roads still survive. So I wonder what people will say in 500 years' time is what survives from the United States, what McDonald hamburger joints, I don't know. But I think that, basically the key thing is, how do other people view the United States? And this is why the figures I provide in my book are not designed to, you know, defend this. But, I mean, why is it that 72% of the Greek population celebrated the hit, so much so that the government...
September 11th attack, celebrated it.
Yeah. Well, when the opinion polls in Greece went out, like in all the European countries, the government suppressed them because 72% said they supported the hits. You wouldn't get such a high figure in an Islamic country, I promise you that, where people in Brazil... in Bolivia, came out onto the streets and danced in some cases. Mm. This happened. And, you know, you have to ask yourselves why they do that. What is their perception? And their perception is that this is an empire which has backed regimes over us, not ruled directly, but backed military dictatorships which have wreaked havoc in our society.
In the case of the Greeks, the colonels in the 60s. Well remember that. So in other words, there is out there the sort of residuum of resentment to any large power, and especially perhaps to this one, because we talk so much about democracy and freedom, and our interests often don't allow us to pursue those goals. Or put it another way, we don't abide by those mandates in our behavior.
No, A, you don't, and B, the other thing which today really preoccupies not just the Arab world, but also the Europeans, is Israel.
And we end there. Tariq Ali, thank you very much. Tariq Ali is the author of The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Crusades, Jihads, and Modernity. Check out the latest news from around the world. It's on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...